Call the next case.
Civil versus Commonwealth, Willis and Abraham, Appellant Counsel, Christopher D. Sandoval, Appellant Counsel.
You may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, my name is Shalev Ben Abraham. I'm from the Fairfax County Public Defender's Office, and I represent Ms. Dorothy Silva. Your Honor, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, the assignment of error in this case is whether or not the Court of Appeals erred in declaring Ms. Silva's appeal moot and dismissing it on that ground. I want to start with, Your Honor, that I believe this is one of the rare times where the Commonwealth and the appellant agree. The Commonwealth cites in page 18 of their brief that the Commonwealth, quote, the Commonwealth has concluded that this case is not moot. So I think on that basis alone, there's an agreement. Obviously, we know that the Court is not bound by the agreements of the parties or concessions by the party, but I think it is clear that this case is not moot, and there's two reasons for that.
Well, it's a real good start when the two of you agree.
Yes, Your Honor, I do agree with that. The first issue is why this is not moot is that there are court costs that resulted from Ms. Silva's conviction for the probation violation. And while the Court of Appeals found that it was moot because she was no longer on probation and no longer in jail, the court costs is what render the case not moot. Because if the Court of Appeals had overturned it, or if this court were to overturn her conviction, those court costs would be vacated. And if she's paid them, she would get the money back or wouldn't be required to pay them.
May I ask you this? Going to the merits of the case, the 2009, the September 16 order, why isn't that within the court's subject matter jurisdiction, even though there was a violation of 19.2304, which, as the Commonwealth argues, would arguably violate the court's active jurisdiction only, and thus not make it void ab initio, but merely voidable on direct appeal?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, there's two things to answer that question. The first is that 19.2304, dealing with the extension, decrease, or modification of probation, versus 19.2306 is when there's a revocation hearing. The Commonwealth is citing to Virginia Code Section 17.1-513 in order to claim that there is sort of jurisdiction in perpetuity over anyone who has previously been convicted by a circuit court. Looking first at 17.1-513, Your Honor, it says specifically in there that the circuit courts have original jurisdiction over all felonies, indicted felonies and presentments, and then any indicted informations or misdemeanors. It does not refer to bench warrants. It does not refer to capias. It does not refer to show cause. And what happens is when a probation violation is filed against someone, it's through those mechanisms that the person is brought before the court.
Right, but there's a narrower ground here, and the narrower ground is after the expiration of the probation period, you can still have subject matter jurisdiction to find the defendant in violation for a previous event, right? And then you could issue an extension to probation.
Correct, Your Honor. If the court had used 19.2306, what would happen is 19.2306 has sort of a statute of limitations or time limitation within it, which says that as long as the court issues process alleging that a violation occurred.
So let's say, right, and they didn't do that here. The extension was done without that hearing and without that process, and that's wrong. But that doesn't necessarily mean the court had no subject matter jurisdiction. It just means there was an error, and usually you correct those voidable errors on appeal, if at all.
Well, two issues with that, Your Honor. First, there's a distinction between 19.2306's ability to do that and having brought someone before them on a probation violation, which is a subject matter of the violation of probation, versus through 19.2304, which is the decreasing or increasing or modifying probation. See, 19.2304 does not have that time limitation on it, which means that using that process, it has to have been done before probation ended. And we can see a perfect example, Your Honor, of how this would work. It is essentially, if I said to the Commonwealth after a case, I intend to appeal this case.
I didn't mean to mislead you. I'm not disagreeing with your point about 304. I'm talking about 306.
Yes, Your Honor.
The power under 306 is to extend probation if you have a hearing and find them in violation, even though the probationary period, of course, has already ended prior to the hearing.
That is because process is issued, and I agree
so
with
the court. So it wasn't done here, and that's bad, and that makes it an error. But does it make it an error that renders the court without subject matter jurisdiction?
In this case, yes, Your Honor. And the reason for that is under 306, if it had been done under 306, the court would have issued process, would have had a hearing at which an attorney can actually waive. If you read 306 carefully, subsection B, which is the time limitation, it says that the court may not proceed on a revocation if it's essentially if it's objected to. So there's a waiver there under 306, Your Honor.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but I need to communicate this point because we're talking past each other. You're right. It has to be done correctly, and it wasn't, right? Therefore, there's an error. But then isn't there another question, which is, was the error of such magnitude as to render the court without subject matter as opposed to merely active jurisdiction?
Yes, Your Honor, and the answer to that is, in this case, yes. And the reason for that is that in order for the court to act, it needs both the subject matter jurisdiction as well as it needs the personal jurisdiction, but also what you have is a situation where the court entered an order that there's nothing in the record that shows Ms. Silva was actually even noticed that the order was entered. It was done 32 days after, and I think this court can look to, obviously it's just persuasive, but the Court of Appeals in Wilson, which came out last year, addressed this very issue where a person said, where Mr. Wilson agreed to extend his probation indefinitely. He signed a letter, just like Ms. Silva did, and it took the court 9 months after his probation ended for the court to enter that extension.
Well, doesn't Wilson differ from this case in that the cause for the revocation in Wilson occurred outside the period of suspension, whereas the cause for revocation, whether it was properly or improperly done, occurred within the period of suspension.
Well, Your Honor, that's not my recollection of Wilson. My understanding of Wilson was that there was a restitution issue and that he agreed to indefinitely extend his probation. But you have to remember here in this case, Your Honor, on the facts that we have, Ms. Silva was not actually, there was not a probation violation outstanding as of August 14th, 2009 when her probation ended. There was not one filed. There had been one previously filed and removed. And so when the court entered the order 31 days after it had lost jurisdiction, the court entered an order that it didn't have the power to enter. And the reason why this is important and different than just because it has jurisdiction over a probation violation versus jurisdiction over the ability to extend or decrease. And this is, I think, getting back to your point, Justice Kelsey.
But can I interrupt you to help you focus on at least the questions being asked? And that is, the power under 306 to find a violation before the termination of the probationary period includes the power to also extend, even though there's been a gap between the hearing date and the terminating point of the probationary period. So it's not that the court loses subject matter jurisdiction. It's just as, here's the way you exercise that power, which wasn't exercised properly here. But that's not a subject matter jurisdiction violation, Wilson notwithstanding.
And I think, Your Honor, I think where Ms. Silva disagrees in that and where our argument comes down is that, Your Honor, 304 and 306 are such different mechanisms of what is going on that in the case that you're talking about under 306, someone has committed a probation violation or alleged to have committed a violation against their probation, committed a new offense, not followed the rules. And so the court is then acting in that situation to punish that behavior. It then revokes what was the suspended time and then can either add probation, add new conditions, or essentially give them time served or give them all their time back, whatever the court has available under 306. 304 is not that type of statute. 304 is a statute that allows a court, as long as probation is still going on, to either increase or decrease or modify or change the conditions. And so 304 is a statute that actually allows the court to better further the ability of keeping the probationer, rehabilitating the probationer, or in some cases saying, you know, I initially gave 3 years of active probation. We're 2 years into this. You've been done so well. I'm going to just decrease the active probation. I'm going to change your terms. So the jurisdictions are different. While the court may retain jurisdiction to extend probation through a probation violation, in which there must be a hearing, in which at the hearing the court must find good cause that the person's probation was violated and then can sentence the person again, or the That's not the same as 304. There's no need for that. Under 304, it's just a matter of good cause. And so when the court, and I'm trying, and I really am trying to answer your question, that when the court under 304 extends or changes something that is already ended, it doesn't have the power to do that. While there might be subject matter jurisdiction and personal jurisdiction over Ms. Silva in another vehicle under 306, that's not what happened here. And so as a result of that, the court didn't have potential jurisdiction to do what it did under 304. And that's really the crux of the problem, because if we allow this to occur, if we allow a situation where someone says, I'm going to indefinitely agree to extend my probation, and just as we have here, probation submits that to the Commonwealth attorney, and the Commonwealth fails to submit it to the court, or the court has it and doesn't act on it. And let's say the court doesn't act on it for 2 years. And during that time period, active probation ends, and we go 2 years down the road, and then that person commits a new offense or is alleged to commit a new offense. All of a sudden, the Commonwealth can say, hey, judge, you didn't sign that order. Go ahead and sign it. You had the ability to sign it. Probation ended, but because you had this potential jurisdiction, sign it. Now we can also file a probation violation against the person. Citizens need to be able to know exactly
what... That would be an ex post facto problem. That's not really what we're talking about here.
Well, it wouldn't be ex post facto, Your Honor, because it would have been a violation while she was on probation. It's just that the court didn't enter the probation order in time, which is what we have here. See, what we have here is Ms. Silva didn't violate probation. The conviction she is trying to overturn is for alleged acts that occurred in February of 2013, not alleged acts that occurred before probation ended in 2009. So we wouldn't have an ex post facto issue. But what we do have is this, there's sort of a compelling argument that people need to understand what the limitations are and what is expected of them. And if a court, 3 years, 2 years down the line, can actually enter an order after probation ended and then enforce a probation violation against them, that, quite frankly, is not fair. It's not due process, and I don't believe that that's what the statutes are intended to do in this way in any sense. So, Your Honor, with regard to that specific issue, you have to look at 306 and 304 as different, and the jurisdiction wasn't there under 304. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Chris Chandeville for the Commonwealth. In this appeal, Ms. Silva is arguing that she should be allowed to collaterally attack the circuit court's order extending her probation, which was entered on September 16th, 2009. She's arguing she should be allowed to collaterally attack that order years after the fact because, according to Ms. Silva, the trial court did not follow the correct statutory procedures before entering that order.
It was a consent order, was it not?
It was an order that was entered as a result of the consent given by Ms. Silva when she waived her right to appear in court, represented by counsel, for a hearing before the court entered that order extending her probation. So, yes, it was agreed to, and not only that, after it was entered, there was never any objection raised to that order. There was not any appeal taken from that order.
So if they hadn't reached a deal with the probation officer could have said, look, okay, we've got to have our 306 hearing. If we're not going to do this, we've got to have our 306 hearing because we need to extend everything in order to keep her in drug rehab.
Correct, Your Honor, and the record indicates that they had taken steps in order to make sure that they could have that hearing if they needed to have it. And so having the Commonwealth having relied upon that consent that was given to Silva, she cannot be allowed now to approbate and reprobate when she invited the very circumstances that she's now complaining of.
Well, she could, in theory, if it were beyond the court's subject matter jurisdiction, enter the consent order.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the real question, right?
Yes, Your Honor. So the approbate and reprobate issue does not fully resolve the case. This court still has to decide whether or not the court has subject matter jurisdiction over the case at that time. And I think it's clear, based on 17.1-513, that the circuit courts do have jurisdiction over all felony and misdemeanor indictments and presentments. Here, what the court was exercising was its continuing jurisdiction over the underlying grand larceny conviction and the probation that resulted from that. And in Muhammad versus Commonwealth, the Court of Appeals decided, and I realize it's not binding on this court, but in Muhammad, the court decided a case that was very similar to this and said under 17.1.513, a circuit court has continuing subject matter jurisdiction over cases involving criminal convictions and resulting probation, because that is a type of case the General Assembly has given to circuit courts, to trial courts, in this Commonwealth. So in that case, I think I'd like to read this quote because I think it directly speaks to a concession, inadvertent concession perhaps made in my colleague's opening brief. In Muhammad at page 101, the Court of Appeals wrote, quote, "While the authority to exercise jurisdiction is a type of jurisdiction, it is distinct from subject matter jurisdiction." On page 14 of my opposing counsel's brief, opening brief in this court, the bottom half of the page, the third sentence in that paragraph, Silva argues, "While it is true that the trial court could still exercise jurisdiction over Ms. Silva until August 14, 2010, so until after that extension order was entered, under Virginia Code Section 192.306B, it is clear from the record the trial court did not enter an order extending her probation following a probation revocation hearing as authorized under Virginia Code Section 192.306.
Which translated means is a violation of active jurisdiction but not subject matter jurisdiction.
Correct, Your Honor. That's the way I read it. I think that is consistent with the way the distinction between subject matter jurisdiction and active jurisdiction has been described by this court and by the Court of Appeals. However, I do note that conflating the issue of subject matter jurisdiction and active jurisdiction is not without precedent in the Commonwealth. And in fact, we have submitted that this court should take this opportunity to overrule the Court of Appeals opinion in Wilson. In Wilson, which is a decision an opinion that was issued while this particular case was pending. In Wilson, the Court of Appeals did exactly that same thing. The Court of Appeals conflated the issues of active jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction. In the case that was factually similar to this case, in that case there had been this agreement to extend terms of probation for a period of time, made with the probation office. The trial court didn't enter an order memorializing that until several months after the fact. And in Wilson, and there was no objection to that order at the time, just like occurred here. There's no immediate objection. So in Wilson, the Court of Appeals had to ask, before we get to the merits of this case, we need to decide, is this a case where that can be collaterally attacked? And the way that the Court of Appeals analyzed that question is the Court of Appeals said, okay, this case can only be collaterally attacked if it's challenging the circuit court's active jurisdiction. And that clearly is incorrect. It can only be collaterally attacked if it's a challenge of the court's subject matter jurisdiction, also known as potential jurisdiction. And the cases cited by the Court of Appeals in Wilson are the Court of Appeals' prior decision in Dunham and two decisions by this court in Virginia Pilot and in Andrews. And in all of those cases, this court and the Court of Appeals had previously held that a litigant can collaterally attack challenges to a subject matter jurisdiction or potential jurisdiction because that cannot be waived by the parties, so it can't even be waived by invited error. However, in Wilson, what the Court of Appeals cited those cases and said, so these cases support the proposition that you can collaterally attack a trial court's lack of active jurisdiction, and quoted from those cases where those cases had said such jurisdiction could be collaterally attacked. If you read the context of those cases, though, they're clearly talking about subject matter jurisdiction.
Was there any petition to rehear in bank from Wilson?
There was not a petition for appeal filed in that case, no, Your Honor. And I would submit to the court...
That's the best way of addressing simple mistakes that all of us make from time to time.
Yes, Your Honor, that is the best way of addressing that. And my opposing counsel has submitted that is somehow some concession that we think that case was properly decided on those particular grounds. And I would just submit to the court that there are multiple reasons why a litigant might choose not to appeal a certain decision, and that decision in that case should not be read as a concession that we think it was rightly decided on those particular grounds. And I can stand before the court today and submit that our office's position is that case was wrongly decided on the issue of subject matter jurisdiction, and that this case presents the opportunity to correct that mistake. And I think it's an important opportunity. If this court remands this case back down to the Court of Appeals for a decision on the merits in the first instance, the panel is going to feel bound by Wilson, given the fact that it's similar facts, and given the fact that there the court went ahead and reached the merits, despite the fact that it was a collateral attack to what was really the court's subject matter jurisdiction. So it put the Commonwealth in a position of essentially having to ask the court to take the case en banc to correct the error, which I understand Your Honor's point about perhaps it would have been the best course in the first instance. However, in the interest of judicial economy, this case does present an opportunity to correct that mistake. It's presented fairly on the four corners of the case that's before this court, and we would ask the court to take that opportunity and make that important correction to the Court of Appeals case law. So the Court of Appeals should reach the merits and affirm because this is an attempt to collaterally attack. Because it's an attempt to collaterally attack that underlying conviction, there's no reason to continue that litigation further and allow that collateral attack to continue by sending the case back to the Court of Appeals for further determination. Roe provides, this court's opinion in Roe provides the authority for reaching the merits despite the fact, based on that invited error that occurred in Roe, the same has occurred here. Finally, on the kind of merits argument that is put forth, there's this argument by Sealwell that there was some sort of contract with conditions subsequent that all the parties agreed to. A court only speaks through its written orders. If you read the order itself on page 21 of the appendix, it is clear that the probation was extended indefinitely or until an additional order of the court is entered. There's an argument that what the judge must have really meant was it was continued only until Ms. Sealwell completed her treatment and resolved some pending felony issues. That is not in the court's order. The court subsequently, ruling on the motion to dismiss, interpreted its own order and said that the extension was indefinitely and that there was no limiting purpose for her to complete the terms of her treatment. And for that reason, this argument that there's some sort of a contract that was violated and ending her probation certainly fails. So for those reasons, unless there are any further questions from the court, I'm happy to rest on my brief and ask the court to reach the merits and to affirm for the reasons stated. Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just briefly, I want to address the approbating, reprobating. That's not what we have here. Ms. Silva signed an extension, the letter saying she was agreeing to the extension. It was then left up to probation, the Commonwealth, and the court to execute that. She did not ask for a delay. She didn't ask for a continuance. She didn't ask anything of the court that pushed it past the probation period ending. So she did no act. She comes with clean hands with regard to that. And if the court had acted appropriately before her probation had ended, if they had signed the order on August 13th, if they had signed the order on August 14th, we wouldn't be here. But the court didn't. The court let probation end, and then it signed the order. Your Honor, I want to also point out that at this point, we are here on an assignment of error of whether or not this case was moot. So I agree with the AG, the assistant AG, that if this court wants to find that it's a void order, obviously the court can reach that. But there were other assignments of error, including this contract issue, which were not fleshed out, were not argued in front of the Court of Appeals. And if the court does find that this case is not moot, but there's the potential that it is void but not void, it should be sent back to the Court of Appeals on that ground, because there would obviously be some sort of, there's a split of authority to some extent in the Court of Appeals. First, we have the Wilson case, but also the case Muhammad that is being cited is a Court of Appeals case, which would seem to indicate a different opinion or a different decision by that court, creating two different panel sort of opinions on when the jurisdiction in probation violations is active versus subject matter jurisdiction.
Is Wilson consistent with the Supreme Court jurisprudence? I mean, have we ever held that a violation of active jurisdiction renders an order void ab initio for purposes of collateral attack? I thought the principle was exactly the opposite.
Your Honor, I don't think that it is being presented as clearly. I think Wilson is a little bit different than just a matter of active versus subject matter jurisdiction. I think in Wilson we have the same issue, which is that the Court of Appeals is saying once a person's probation ends, jurisdiction ends to extend it under 304 because there's no time limitation or mechanism to do that, which is different than the one-year time limitation. Remember that the court may issue process on a probation revocation under 306 as long as it does so within 1 year of probation ending. Anything that occurs in that 1 year that it has to issue that process would not be part of the violation. The violation occurs prior, so it ends at some point. There has to be finality. And litigants, and especially defendants, need to know the finality of what is expected of them. And so I don't think that Wilson is exactly about trying to change something about active jurisdiction, but is actually dealing with that specific 304 versus 306. I see that my time is ended.
Call the next.